This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. We're broadcasting today from a tent on the site of the new National Museum of the American Indian. Around us right now on the nation's mall, workers are busy putting last-minute touches on the First Americans Festival that goes with the museum's opening. And tomorrow morning, thousands of Native Americans, possibly tens of thousands, will pass this spot on their way to inaugurate the latest Smithsonian Museum in a ceremony unlike any seen in Washington before, which is an appropriately grand beginning for a museum unlike any seen in Washington before. If you're familiar with the marble, glass, and concrete face of our nation's capital, you're in for a surprise. The National Museum of the American Indian rises like a buttery, wind-sculpted cliff at the base of Capitol Hill. It's surrounded by the native ecosystem in miniature, squash and cornfields, forest, wetlands, and cascading waters. Inside, the display reflects an unprecedented collaboration between Smithsonian curators and tribal groups. When the doors open tomorrow, the museum will immediately become Washington's hottest new tourist destination. For those of you who can't be here, today we offer a sneak peek over the radio. This hour on Talk of the Nation, we'll take an audio tour of the new museum from the grandfather rocks at its base to the artifacts still in its attic and hear the many stories that went into its creation. And we want to hear, of course, from you. If you have questions about any of the various aspects of the museum, what's in the collection, what isn't, how curators decided what to display, what the museum hopes to become, join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us here in the tent is W. Richard West, director of the new National Museum of the Native American of Cheyenne and Arapaho background. Rick West, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
Let's start with the obvious contrast. Across the mall, the Museum of Natural History has collections of Native artifacts displayed in pretty traditional fashion. How does the thinking change as you come across the park to this new museum?
Well, I think the National Museum of the American Indian is a change in this respect, and it's not that we're not utterly respectful of the way in which other systems of knowledge, such as anthropology and our sister institution, the National Museum of Natural History, have been used to interpret Native peoples and communities. But what we hope to do at the National Museum of the American Indian is to draw the voice, the first-person voice, of Native people into the conversation about Native cultures and peoples and communities. So when people come to our museum, they will see a systematic, disciplined, scholarly method of trying to make sure that those from whom our visitors hear are Native peoples themselves, so that we will be interpreted at least at this magnitude and on this scale as never done before, by people in the first-person voice rather than the third-person voice. And we feel that that will bring new meaning and new perspectives to our ideas, our cultures, our histories, and the beautiful objects that comprise the 800,000 object collections of the National Museum of the American Indian.
If there's one phrase we hear over and over again in relation to this new museum, it's a native place. That goes along with your idea of this first-person presentation.
That's absolutely correct, and it's not just a matter of what is said in the exhibitions or what is said in the public programs. As you pointed out in your introductory comments, you feel almost as soon as you walk onto the site in light of the eco-environment that it's a different kind of place you're entering. I know just a couple of months ago in the Smithsonian Magazine, the secretary said, well, when you're walking down the National Mall, that is the secretary of the Smithsonian, you know you're surrounded by museums, but museums of what? In our case, I think people will know that they've come to a different cultural point of destination.
Who is this museum for?
This museum has multiple audiences. I want to emphasize that. We consider Native peoples to be our primary constituents in the sense that we want them to have some kind of valuable intellectual ownership of what is said in this place. But having that constituency doesn't mean that you don't speak to a number of different audiences. Frankly, 95% of the people who visit that building every year, the 4 million that we estimate will come every year, are non-Native. So we want to make sure that this becomes a conversation between Native people on the one side as our chief interpreters and representatives of Native culture and the millions of non-visitors who come to see us, because they are what we are for, too.
The museum is also a result of a collaboration and various kinds of efforts, all kinds of different groups, but it begins with tribal groups, doesn't it?
Well, it is a conversation between cultural communities and our publics, and that is a very thin line that the National Museum of the American Indian is sometimes required to walk. We're not kind of a meaningless conglomeration of pan-Indianism. The fact is that I am sitting here right now talking with you as a Southern Cheyenne because there is a Southern Cheyenne cultural community still in existence. So it is our tribal communities or our specific cultural communities that have given life to our history and to our present. On the other hand, there are ideas that transcend all of the diversity in Native America, attitudes, values of life, the way we see the world, that are common to all tribal communities and Native communities throughout the hemisphere. So it's doing both of those things at once that I think is important.
And there are exhibits in the museum that reflect the worldview and the artifacts and the art of various tribal groups. And as you say, there are also communal areas that reflect common things. But tell us how you went into negotiations, as you know far better than I. The idea of representations of Indian artifacts is extremely controversial.
Well, I really have not found it that much of a challenge, to be perfectly honest. From the very beginning, we indicated that our approach to interpreting and representing Native culture would always be based upon a distinct collaboration, a mutually participatory relationship with Native communities whom we were purporting to interpret and represent. And if you begin at that point, notwithstanding the sometimes troubled and tension-filled relationship between Indian communities and museums, I think you get to the right place. And what we have found is a result of following this process for the better part of a decade and a half at this point, Native communities have a comfort with what we are saying about them because it is they who are saying it that is very different from any relationship I have ever seen between museums on the one hand and Native communities on the other hand.
We're speaking with Rick West, who's director of the Smithsonian's new Museum of the American Indian, opens tomorrow here on the Mall in Washington, D.C. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. We're going to begin with a question from our audience here in the tent on the Mall. And, sir, just tell us your name and ask us your
question. My name is John Kalongi. I'm Aleut Eskimo. And my question to Rick is, you started this mission 15 years ago. 100 years from now, we're going to be telling your story. I'm sorry. It means so much to me. We're going to be telling your story. What can we say? What will Indian people say that you felt at this very moment?
Well, I appreciate that. And John and I know each other very well because he worked at the museum for a very long time. I would have to say that I have never been happier than I am right now. And I am happy not only because of my personal journey in this position as the director of the museum, but I am happy because I think that it brings all of Native America, all of Native people, to a different point in history. I think in working to resolve those distinctions and what has happened in the past, Native Americans, along with non-Native Americans, are in the position of achieving new points of beginning that go forward from here. And that's what the National Museum of the American Indian is about. It is about being honest about the past, but it is about overcoming that past and noting that we have survived that past to begin together to go from here to a very different place in the future. That's our aspiration.
And a wonderful response, but how do you feel?
How do I feel? Well, believe it or not, I feel relaxed. Everybody keeps asking me, well, why aren't you nervous? Aren't you wrapped up about all of this? And I said, absolutely not. As far as I'm concerned, my challenges sit primarily behind me as the director. There are lots of my staff who are indeed stressed as we get ready to open tomorrow. Believe me, that's the case. So I'm not... But they sometimes think I've just become so numb, I don't really know what's going on. But I do. And the reason that I am as serene, I think, as I am now and on the glide path toward the opening is because we're human and we may have made mistakes, but we have been consistent about the mission of this institution from the very beginning. And I think that most Native people recognize the honesty of our effort in trying to transform this cultural institution into a place that not just speaks not just about Native Americans, but it is actually of the First Peoples of this hemisphere.
Let's take a call from our listening audience. Vera joins us from Greensboro, North Carolina. Vera, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm curious about how the museum is going to address the genocide or the destruction, really, of the people, really.
Request?
I understand the question, and I will say that we expect to be honest and direct about it. One of our exhibitions, one of the three permanent exhibitions, is entitled Our Peoples, and that is basically Native peoples telling their own histories or those events which were important in their histories. And then there is part of the exhibit that is done by our own curators, and that is to try to be very honest about what the destructive elements of the sharp edge of colonialism were in this hemisphere. It involved disease and guns and swords and the search for gold and Bibles, for that matter. All of these had impact upon the progress or the lack of progress of Native cultures, and we want to be very open about that. But, you know, I also want to be sure that having discussed that and been very honest about those tattered edges of American history, that people understand a couple of things. First of all, that the main point to remember in all of that is that we are still here right now, 30 to 40 million of us strong throughout the hemisphere. And second, that we will insist on a kind of cultural future that we're not willing to leave behind. We fought hard to stay here. We're not leaving anytime soon. And that is the message that we want to convey. I also want people to understand that 500-year Holocaust, as horrible as it was, constitutes exactly 5% of the total time that we have been here. We are about being honest about that experience, but we're also about trying to show people that Native American history went back thousands of years before that and it'll go thousands of years forward. And we want to make sure that we capture that complete picture in interpreting Native America.
There are, of course, some difficult aspects of current reality, though. Continuing poverty on many reservations, high rates of diabetes, alcoholism. Is there an obligation to use the museum to discuss those issues as well?
I think there's an obligation on the part of the museum to address any issues that have an impact on culture. And those issues do have impacts on culture. And we want to be very honest about those issues, too. On the one hand, we are not, unfortunately, a social service agency from the standpoint of providing services in that regard. But I'm interested in all of those constituent elements of what makes up cultural history. And so, of course, we have to touch upon some of those. There's an exhibition in this set of opening exhibitions. It's about gaming, for example, hot topic in Indian country and elsewhere. And we want to let a Native community, the Kumeyaay community, the Campo community of Kumeyaay Indians in Southern California, talk about that issue and to tell us both the economic upside to it and whatever else they wish to tell us about cultural issues that may actually raise too.
We just have about 45 seconds or so left in this segment, but there's one of the manifestos for the museum calls for it to address and rise above stereotypes. I can see a lot of rising above. I don't see a lot of addressing of stereotypes in the museum.
Oh, I don't really think that's true, if I may say so. I think what addressing stereotypes is about is trying to give people a better understanding of the complexities of Indian culture, who we really are as a people, fully human. We actually have senses of humor, which nobody ever attributes to us, but quite frankly, which is all that kept us alive through much of the past 500 years. Once you start talking about the reality of Native cultures and their fullness, and fullness as people, then you begin, by definition, getting rid of stereotypes.
Rick West is the director of the Smithsonian's new Museum of the American Indian, the National Museum of the American Indian. We'll be back with one or two more questions for him. He's got a very busy schedule today, as you might appreciate, and we're thanking him very much for your time. Also, more questions for you as we take an audio tour of this wonderful new facility on the Nation's Mall, 800-989-8255. I'm Neil Cohn, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The new National Museum of the American Indian opens tomorrow here in Washington. Today we're coming to you from the opening festivities outside on the National Mall. The museum's current exhibits include contributions from 24 Native groups and over 3,500 objects from a permanent collection. We're giving you a radio tour this hour. Of course, you're invited to join us. What are your questions about the exhibits or any other aspects of the museum? Our number, as always, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. We're talking right now with Museum Director Rick West, and let's get another question from the audience here on the mall.
Good afternoon. My name is Kristen Thomas. I'm Six Nations Iroquois Cayuga from Six Nations Grand River. And I was just wondering approximately how many different tribal groups physically participated in, you know, contributing artifacts and different, perceptions.
Could I throw another element onto her list? How about money? Go ahead.
Well, first of all, the museum has collections from virtually every Native community in the hemisphere, and that's hundreds of Native communities. There, of course, are 562 federally recognized tribes right here in the United States, and I can't think of a single one from whom we don't have some objects in the collection. So there's great diversity that way. I would point out that in the procession, which is going to kick things off tomorrow morning, there'll be approximately 20,000, if not more, Native people. We have 200 to 300 different Native communities represented right there. So there is tremendous diversity in the people who have participated with us through time. Money, that's been a very important question to us, frankly. It always is for a museum. Congress mandated that we raise a great deal of the money for the construction of this beautiful Native place you see on the mall across the street now privately. They provided about $120 million. We coughed up another $80 million privately. Now, what's interesting to me is that of that $80 million, $35 million of it came directly out of the Native community. When you consider that we constitute one-half of 1% of the population and that most of Native America still lives in the state of a third-world economy, I think it's remarkable that Native America stepped forward in that way, those who could, and gave us that amount of money. So we're grateful to the Indian community in many ways, including that one.
And one final question, Rick, before we let you go. An email question from Boyd in Salt Lake City, Utah. Was there controversy over the name Indian?
Oh, that's a long explanation. But here's all I would say. Congress named the museum. I did not. American Indian, I suppose, shows basically that Columbus was lost when he got to this hemisphere. I think this distinction between Native American, American Indian is something that is kind of beside the point for most Native people. If you ask me who I am, I will tell you if it's an English Southern Cheyenne. In my own language, Tsistas. That's who we are. That simply means human being in the Cheyenne language. And that's how we refer to ourselves. And the debate back and forth over which this one, that, they're all slightly confusing. So we leave that to others to sort out. We call ourselves what our communities themselves have always called themselves.
Rick West, thank you very much. And again, congratulations. 14 long years of work.
Thank you very much.
Rick W. Richard West is director of the new Smithsonian Museum of the American Indian. He joined us in our broadcast tent on the National Mall, where the opening festivities for this site will be getting underway tomorrow. The experience of the National Museum of the American Indian starts long before you actually enter its doors. The site is surrounded by a painstakingly designed and yet entirely naturalistic landscape. Donna House joins us now by cell phone from the entrance to the museum. It's only about 2.5 blocks over my left shoulder. She's an ethnobotanist who worked on the landscape design team and herself Navajo and Oneida. Donna, good of you to have you on Talk of the Nation. Can you begin by describing your surroundings a bit for us, if you would? You're standing in front of the doors facing towards the Capitol.
Well, actually, I'm just northeast of the door to the entrance of the museum. I'm in an area just right next to the wetlands habitat, and I actually can see the cascade of water coming down from this wonderful north part of the building, northwest part of the building.
The entrance to the museum, though, is at the east end, and I understand there's some significance to that. And normally, a marketer might have told you to put it next to the Air and Space Museum at the other end of the building.
Well, that's very true. As you and a lot of natives know, that entrance to a dwelling, to a native dwelling, the door faces the east. Most native people in North and South America, Dora's face, they used to greet the sun. And as far as the entrance to this native place is actually in the northwestern part of the site here. The landscape the entrance to the site begins with the landscape, with the forest habitat greeted by the water and grandfather boulders.
The grandfather boulders, what are those?
Well, several years ago when we were all working and listening to native people across the country, there was this elder by the name of William Tomball. He was Northern Cheyenne, and he talked about the significance of the ancient people being of stone, of boulders, of rocks, and how they were here before human beings, before the five-finger people, as we say in the Dene way. And he said, greeting is such an important element to Native people. And so using his strong statement, the entrance to the site, you're greeted by these boulders that are from Elma, Canada, that are 2.5 billion years old, and a cascade of water. As you know, there are songs and stories and the importance of water, and water plays a great role with Native people, and the water has different voices. So we have a cascade that breaks down into different heights that visually and listening to different, you can hear the different parts of it.
I wanted to find out a little bit more also about the different ecosystems that are represented. Obviously, limited by you are by Washington, D.C.'s location, these are limited to a certain part of the country.
Well, yes. As far as honoring the land and with working with a team Native people, we developed the philosophy. The philosophy was going to be of this area. Land has memory. Land has spirit. In order to honor the people that were extirpated and species that were extirpated, one of the things that was very so important is to bring back and have respect and honor the people that have disappeared by having native plants and just recognizing the eastern vegetation.
One of the things that most people don't understand. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
And the other part of your question was the different habitat.
Right.
This area is surrounded by native species. The northern part is a forest habitat. And the reason I use forest habitat rather than forest landscape is that when you're working with plants and shrubs and soils, there are more here than just plants. There are the critters, there's the butterflies, there's the dragonflies. There's all these other wonderful creatures that come along with it. So there are other creatures that inhabit this site besides plants. So we have the north side, that's the forest, and the eastern part of the site is a wetlands. The southern part is the crops and meadow.
It's an ambitious and what was the most difficult part?
Well, the most difficult part was actually trying to locate native plants. A lot of nurseries in the area are focusing on species that are most popular to the area, and native species are not high on the list. A lot of exotics. So I didn't realize that was going to be a challenge, but that most certainly was a challenge.
Well, Donna House, you've done a magnificent job. The grounds are a central part of the museum and part of its great attraction. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Donna House is an ethnobotanist by trade. She worked on the design project team for the National Museum of the American Indian, and we spoke to her from the grounds of the museum, a couple of blocks over my left shoulder here. Joining us now in the tent is Dwayne Blue Spruce, facilities planner for the National Museum of the American Indian of the Laguna and San Juan Pueblo peoples, and it's good of you to join us today.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
We've talked about the grounds. Now tell us a little bit about the building. For those who haven't seen it yet, This is quite an engineering marvel, isn't it?
Yeah, it was a real challenge to work on such a fairly restrictive site. It's a 4.25-acre site, which is a relatively small site for the National Mall. Of course, it's one of the most prominent locations, but it was a real challenge to work with such a tight site with such a curvilinear and organic building.
Did you get any objections when this building turned out not to look a whole lot like any of the other buildings here on the Mall?
Actually, we didn't get too many objections, to tell you the truth. We, being on the National Mall, we did have to go through the regular regulatory agencies and approval process, and that included the Commission of Fine Arts and the National Capital Planning Commission. And it was interesting, from very early on, they were very supportive of the major design concepts and the design overall.
Once you get inside, give us an idea of how the exhibit space is laid out. I know that there are temporary special exhibits and permanent ones as well.
Sure. We've got it's a five-story building, five stories above ground, and the first four floors are for the public. And our major gallery and exhibition spaces are on the third and fourth floor. We have three permanent exhibitions, two of which are on the fourth floor, one of which is on the third floor, and a changing exhibition gallery on the third floor.
Now, a lot of these exhibit various kinds of artifacts. As people know, displaying Native American objects often comes with some concerns because they have modern-day spiritual significance. Has this issue of repatriation come up in the process of, assembling and displaying this collection?
It has, and we have a very strong repatriation department within the museum. It's led by Jim Pepper Henry, and the museum has been very proactive in its repatriation policies and working with Native communities in that regard.
There are ceremonial objects on display, though. Are they still considered sacred by the peoples from whom they came?
It's a very interesting question because different people have different interpretations about particular objects and when they're sacred and so on and when they can be exhibited. And it's something that the museum has worked directly with the communities on getting approvals for exhibiting specific objects and working with and following proper cultural protocols.
Here's an email question from Judy in Prior Lake, Minnesota. Will the bricks in the dedication wall be accessible?
The question may be a little bit off. There's a what we call the honor wall located inside the museum, and the honor wall is a wall. It was a fundraising effort by our fundraising group, and it's a place where you, for $150, you can get your name or your family's name permanently inscribed on a panel that gets inserted onto a wall inside the museum. And so the target, I think, is for 40,000 names to go on that wall. And so far, I think we've received about 15,000 names and inscriptions. And physically, the wall is still being installed. But one of the nice things is we do have the full database available in the resource center, so people who come over the next week or so will be able to look up their name on the computer.
We're speaking with Dwayne Blue Spruce, facilities planner of the National Museum of the American Indian. We're broadcasting today live from the site of this new Smithsonian institution. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's take a phone call now. Karen's joining us from San Francisco. Karen, you're on the air.
Hi, Neil. Thank you. Yes, I'm calling from San Francisco, which is on Ohlone Land. And I'm wondering if the museum displays will represent the interests and the cultures of non-federally recognized tribes. And the reason I ask that is because California gets so much media coverage on gaming, which I think undermines or ignores a lot of meaningful cultural revitalization efforts that are going on in California by non-federally recognized tribes.
Dwayne Blue Spruce, can you address that?
Yeah, it's a complicated issue. We have federal recognized tribes obviously included in our exhibitions, and it's something that the museum sort of looks to others to assist us in sort of working with those tribes that are non-federally recognized. For example, we have several people on our staff who are Lumbee, and that's a tribe that's tried for several years to get federal recognition. I see a Lumbee cheering in the audience. And we are very supportive of these efforts and do all we can to work with those tribes and work with them in the museum as well.
Thanks very much for the phone call. Are there concerns that this museum will be seen as sugarcoating the American Indian experience for, American consumption?
Yeah, I think that's a somewhat unfair criticism because knowing how much collaboration has gone into the development of the exhibitions and how closely the museum has consulted with Native communities for the past 14 years and beyond, we are very much telling the true stories of Native people and telling it from a Native perspective and respecting that authority in all of our exhibitions. And I think when people go through them, there'll be a lot of their preconceived notions about Native Americans will be challenged. And there's a lot of very informative and message-laden exhibitions in the museum.
As soon as tomorrow, somebody's going to walk through that front door wearing a Washington Redskins jersey, isn't it?
No doubt. That's an issue that it's kind of an irony because lately in the Washington Post, for example, you'll have pictures of the latest Redskins game right next to articles about the opening of the museum, but I think that's it's a good thing because I think people are looking at that and realizing that there may be something wrong with this picture, and I think the worst thing about the whole mascot issue is how it dehumanizes a culture and a people, and I hope something that will change over time. Change does occur. Sometimes it takes a long time, but we're hoping that's something that will change over time.
And one other area of Indian culture you're trying to open everybody's eyes to is Indian cuisine. There's quite an interesting new museum cafe.
Yeah, that's right. We have a Mitzi Tom cafe. Mitzi Tom is a word from the Piscataway and Delaware language, which means let's eat. And we wanted the cafe to be really an extension of the museum's educational mission. And to that end, we've developed an entirely Native menu for the cafe so that people will come to the museum, they'll be able to sample different Native foods from different regions, learn something about different Native cuisine, and have really good food.
We welcome you to join our conversation. We're broadcasting live today from the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian on the Mall here in Washington, D.C. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. If you have questions about the opening of this new museum, what's in it, what should be, what isn't, give us a shout. I'm Neil Conan. We'll be right back after a break. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today we're on the side of the National Mall in Washington, D.C., where the inauguration of the National Museum of the American Indian gets underway tomorrow. The doors will be officially open then. Today we're taking you on a sneak peek inside the collection. If you have questions about the exhibits of the new museum, give us a phone call. Are you planning to visit? Are you curious about how certain themes or events will be handled? Our number is 800-989-8255. Email is totn@npr.org. While the museum occupies a single address on the National Mall, there are festivities occurring throughout the area this week. Right now in the background, you may be able to hear the sounds of the First Americans Festival being set up. This six-day celebration includes concerts, dances, traditional art forms. Native Americans from across the country and throughout the hemisphere are on their way to the opening, arriving by air, road, train, and water. Out on the Potomac River, members of the Penobscot Nation from Maine are paddling a traditional birch bark canoe towards Washington to take their part in tomorrow's opening ceremonies. Joining us here in the tent is Dwayne Blue Spruce, facilities planner for the new museum. And let me ask you, there's some discussion in Museum of Materials about the fact that American Indians are often only portrayed as historical beings, that the modern side of Native identity is often left out. How does the museum address this?
Well, we work directly with Native communities on curating our exhibitions, and essentially each one of our permanent exhibitions has 8 community curated sections, and the museum worked directly with those communities on developing their portions of the exhibitions. So it's people presenting their stories, their histories from a contemporary perspective. And in particular, one of our permanent exhibitions called Our Lives addresses the whole issue of Native identity and Native people living in contemporary society.
And which tribes are featured this time, and will that rotate?
It will rotate. I unfortunately can't rattle off the names off the top of my head, but there are eight communities located in that gallery. And one of them, for example, is a Métis group from Canada. And one of the it's proven to be one of the favorite objects of people who've already been into the exhibitions on our staff is a bombardier, which is kind of a cross between a tank, a snowmobile, and a Hummer. And it's used by that community for ice fishing. And it just when we asked them to select an object for their part of the exhibition, they chose the bombardier because it really represents their way of life. And, you know, it's a vehicle that they use all the time.
And it reminds us of the diversity of this is not just for Indians from the United States, but from Native peoples from all the way from the tip of Alaska all the way to the tip of South America.
Absolutely. The museum's collection, 800,000 object collection, it spans the whole hemisphere, and roughly 70% of our collection is from North America, and 30% is from Central and South America. So that's our constituency, and that's the people we represent in the museum.
Mm-hmm. Let's take another question. This is Sarah in Portland, Oregon. Sarah, you're on the air.
Hi, I love your show.
Thank you.
I'm calling on September 12, 2001. I was at a rodeo where they had an Indian village, and on top of all the teepees, they had a lot of American flags, and I took a photograph, but it led me to think about the patriotism of American Indians and how you might assimilate, or, you know, how Indians assimilate into our culture as Americans and not a separate culture, as they always seem to be.
So does Dwayne Blue Spruce, does the museum show Indians as Americans as well as Cheyenne, Arapaho, whatever?
Absolutely. American Indians are some of the most patriotic people in the country and have represented this country in the armed forces in incredible numbers. And it's a tradition that Native people are very proud of, and that is how we are portrayed in the museum.
Thank you for the call. And Dwayne Blue Spruce, we wanted to thank you for your time today. We know you must be extremely busy here. What are you most looking forward to tomorrow, by the way?
Looking forward to just the doors opening and having the public experience the museum the way we've been experiencing it over the past few days as staff people running around, just experiencing all the wonderful spaces and exhibitions in the museum. It's a real thrill for me personally. I've been working on this project for almost 10 years now, and seeing things that were just an idea on a piece of paper, you know, 10 years ago, and seeing those things built and people experiencing them is just a real thrill, and I can't wait for the doors to open tomorrow.
Is there one spot in the museum or one exhibit that's always been the problem child, the equivalent in the New York Mets search for a third baseman?
I don't know. It's hard to say. I mean, the construction of the building has been quite complicated because of obviously the complex geometry of the building, and you know, we experienced numerous, you know, times where a lot of people stood around scratching their heads about particular details. But I couldn't isolate a particular problem child, but it has been a complicated project for sure.
Well, again, congratulations. We appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Dwayne Blue Spruce is facilities planner at the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian. In addition to displays of culture and history, the new museum devotes one of its exhibit halls to two modernist Native American artists. Joining us now to talk about the state of contemporary Native art is Truman Lowe, curator of the museum's contemporary art exhibit, himself a famed sculptor from the Ho-Chunk tribe, and it's good of you to be with us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
We should point out it's important to note this is not an art museum, but there is art in it.
Yes, I think one can look at it and has a personal definition that all aspects of it are artful.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us about the two particular artists featured in this opening exhibit, George Morrison and Alan Hauser.
Yes, the exhibit really is in a sense, a bit of a retrospective of these two magnificent artists. They are... Morrison is actually a Chippewa from northern Minnesota, actually a Grand Portage Chippewa. Mm-hmm. And His career was basically Euro-American trained. He was successful as a young person, as an artist, and actually got a scholarship to the Minnesota College of Art and Design, and then from there moved on to the Art Student League in New York, and actually was ultimately a part of the Abstract Expressionist movement. Various aspects of modernism are certainly evident in his work in this exhibit, and ultimately returned to Minnesota, where he continued the a second career of teaching at the University of Minnesota, and ultimately retired back to the community. Mm-hmm. Alan Hauser is actually born in Oklahoma, Chiricahua Apache. Worked and grew up and ultimately moved to Santa Fe, and there studied with Dorothy Dunn in the School of Art, and then took a variety of positions and ultimately began teaching art initially as a mural. He was a muralist and also a painter, did a lot of works on paper, and ultimately, I knew both of these gentlemen, so I used to tease him, because in 1948 he did his first public sculpture, and that's on exhibit here in the museum. He did a piece called Comrade in Mourning, and it was a public commission which he won, and it's a carving done in marble. And once he did that piece, he never turned back. And the exhibit is actually a series of his works throughout his lifetime. And from that point, he also began to teach, and as in his teaching career, took him to various schools within the government programs. He also did some paintings. There are, for those of you that live and reside here in Washington, D.C., a series of murals at the Department of Interior. And if you haven't seen those, you must go see those. And ultimately, he began teaching art at, in particular, developed the sculpture program at the Institute of American Indian Art in Santa Fe, and where he resided until 1994, when he passed away.
We're speaking with Truman Lowe, the curator of contemporary art at the National Museum of the American Indian. We're broadcasting live from the Mall in Washington, D.C., from the site of the First Americans Festival. No, that isn't the blacksmith shop getting set up next door. It's another tent being raised. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Truman Lowe, let me ask you, would either of these artists have regarded themselves, and maybe it's a different answer for both, as Indian artists or artists who were Indians?
Well, I think you can term that. When you ask that kind of question, you're looking at a time period in which they worked, and I think that when you look at the artists, certainly they are native in their heritage, but much of their work has been influenced by non-natives. I think that when you look at the work of these two artists, they're very diverse. They have, I think, marked a direction which where individual expression became a major focus. And I think that when you look at Morrison's work, he certainly was influenced by the Abstract Expressionists became interested in surrealism, all aspects of contemporary art of his time. And at the same time, Hauser was actually very much influenced by Henry Moore, Barbara Hepworth, Brand Cusey. And these are influences that existed in our lifetimes and in my lifetime as well. And I think that it's difficult to define. I think an artist creates work, and how they're defined by their community or how they're defined by the public is really dependent upon your question. Are they Native? Yes, they are Native. Are they artists? Yes. Are they Native artists? Yes. Are they artists who are Native? Yes.
Let's get another caller on the line, and Ernest is going to join us now from Chelsea, Massachusetts. Ernest, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Yes, I think it's about time that, you know, indigenous cultures were recognized, because all over the world, it's always been like an afterthought. You know, these people were there before the Americans or the Europeans, whoever came there, and places are always named after European discoverers as though people never lived there before. So finally, if they're having a museum to display their cultures, I think it's a good thing. Because, it's, you know, the contributions to the culture, the universal culture as a whole, has so often been overlooked. That's my comment. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Ernest. Given that, Truman Lowe, I wonder, let me put this question to you. It's been an awful long time, this museum, before it finally comes. What took so long?
Well, I think it took about 15 years of actual hard work, but it what preceded 15 years is approximately 500 years of work, and I think much of it is can be referred to as survivance. And I think in that process, there's various aspects of a culture that are affected. One is tradition. What traditions survive? What influences are there? And it's really about, I think it becomes evident when you look at the visual aspects, when you look at what has been created through that time period. I think that's what a collection, and that's what our collection does here at the museum. I think it helps define that particular evolution or the changes, or whether they're seasonal, whether they're geographical. There's a whole sense of what is there are many factors in considering that.
Truman Lowe, thanks very much for being with us. We appreciate your time today. And good
Thank
luck when the opening tomorrow.
Thank you.
Truman Lowe is a sculptor and creator of contemporary and curator of contemporary art at the National Museum of the American Indian, also a professor of art at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. We'd like to thank some of the people who made this broadcast possible. That includes our technical director, Kevin Waite. He had help from Johnny Vince Morris. We'd especially like to thank the staff of the radio program Native America Calling for their generosity and support throughout this process. Susan Brain, Patty Talahongva, John Gahuti and Nola Davies Moses and Wayne Cody. The show would also not have been possible without the work of several people at the National Museum of the American Indian, especially Linda St. Thomas, Caleb Strickland, Suzette Brewer, and Howard Bass. Thanks to all of them and to all of our guests this hour, and thanks to everybody who called. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.